Is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, get ready for this one, an interview here that I have been waiting for with Dr. Michael Sala, and we're going to talk about his thoughts of as many as 57 different extraterrestrial races. I even thought one was enough. 57 extraterrestrial races currently monitoring, interacting with humanity right here on Earth. Dr. Michael Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He is the author of Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. Now, in addition, he has authored four other books, more than 70 articles, chapters, book reviews on peace, ethnic conflict, and conflict resolution. Dr. Sala is currently a researcher in residence in the Center for Global Peace at the American University. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia, and has an MA in philosophy from the University of Melbourne, also in Australia, of course. Dr. Sala's website, www.exopolitics.org, linked up, by the way, coasttocoastam.com, has to date scored almost 3 million hits and continues to attract great interest from those seeking to understand the big picture about the undisclosed extraterrestrial presence and its political implications. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Dr. Michael Sala. Michael, welcome back. How are you?
Wonderful. Thanks, George. Thanks for having me back.
My pleasure. A lot of people fast-blasting me right now saying, George, please have him explain what exopolitics means. So I'll let you do that. What is it?
Well, very briefly, it's the study of the main actors, institutions, and processes concerning an extraterrestrial presence on Earth.
Now, you are a pioneer in this field. Take us back a few years, Michael, when you started getting involved in this. I mean, here you are. You are an expert in global peace. You're degreed quite heavily. How did you get involved in UFOs, the study of extraterrestrials, all of a sudden?
Well, as I've said in the past, my interest has been and continues to be international conflict. And so in understanding international conflict, I began to look at some of the kind of more exotic theories concerning what may be driving international conflict, and then I came across Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project and the 2001 press conference that he did, and what I saw was not so much the kind of UFO phenomenon as a kind of lights in the sky, let's prove that this is really going on phenomenon. What I saw was a political process covering up an extraterrestrial presence which had great implication for the way international politics was conducted. And so as I began to do more research into that, I realized that, in fact, yes, there was a great cover-up, and that there was a hidden infrastructure to deal with that, which consumed vast resources. And, of course, there's a lot of political capital that goes into covering this up. So the whole thing came out of an understanding that covering up the UFO phenomenon involved incredible political implications that just needed to be looked at if anyone was to really understand what was going on
in the international
arena.
If you were to grade them, Michael, on their ability to cover this up, how would you grade them?
Well, I think they've done an incredible job in just keeping this out of the mainstream public arena. In other words, the sort of news that most people consider to be what is going on in the international arena has been really well sanitized of the whole extraterrestrial phenomena. So then one has to get out of the kind of mainstream shows that air at the kind of peak viewing hours, and you go into the alternative media, and I'm not sure if you'd want to classify Coast to Coast as part of that alternative media, but that's really where you do get the discussion about the ET presence happening. So they've done a really good job in sanitizing the mainstream media.
By keeping it under wraps, to me, you would also need then the cooperation of the various alien races, or they themselves would try to make themselves known very easily. So am I right in that thought?
Well, there has been varying degrees of support on the part of different ET races, but certainly there have been some that have benefited greatly from the secrecy and I think have a vested interest in the secrecy continuing. And there have been others that have been trying to overcome the secrecy and been part of an extensive worldwide UFO phenomenon where there have been quite a number of sightings and also contacts. Individuals who have had face-to-face meetings. So we have both sides, ETs supporting and also not supporting this disclosure.
Michael, a debunker would say that we haven't even been visited by one extraterrestrial race, let alone 57. You talk about 57. How were you able to, I guess, catalog 57 different extraterrestrial races?
Well, one has to begin, I believe, with those who have had some direct experience with the ET phenomenon. And I think that probably the one source that does get a lot of attention are the whistleblowers, people who have participated in military intelligence projects that have had some direct interface with ETs. And there are a number of people that I actually do referred to in the study that have had this kind of direct interface. For example, Clifford Stone served in the U.S. Army for 22 years and actually participated in the recovery of UFOs and of the bodies, the personnel that were on these ships. And so he had direct experience with that. And of course, there were others who had that kind of direct experience in terms of the various documents that were part of the cover-up. For example, Sergeant Robert Dean, he served for 27 years in the U.S. Army and was also part of the Supreme Allied Command in Europe. And he part of his job was to brief the commander about the UFO presence and the various ETs to try to coordinate a proper NATO response.
Now tell me a little bit more about what they both specifically have said.
Sure. Well, as far as Clifford Stone is concerned, he had very extensive experience in retrieving craft that had crashed. His job was to be called at short notice from his normal army duties to participate in clandestine recovery efforts around the world. So it wasn't just in the US, but around the world. So he would be called to participate in these efforts. And he would have to go and sanitize the area, that is, make sure that all evidence pointing to an ET craft had being crashed had to be removed, that any witnesses had to be silenced or intimidated, and of course the craft itself had to be retrieved. He wasn't the only one that reported about these crashes. Colonel Steve Wilson was also another who participated in these crash retrievals. So both of them talked about their direct experience as Army personnel in the location and the recovery of these crafts. So they saw what was going on, and part of their job was to make sure that this didn't get out into the mainstream arena.
Let's talk a little bit about the typology of the extraterrestrial races. Was this a study that you undertook? How did you begin to put the data together, Michael?
Well, it really did come out of my need to try and kind of make sense of the various descriptions that were made by a number of sources on who exactly is visiting here. I mean, comes across claims by different authors. Clifford Stone, for example, was the one that said that there were 57 different ET races visiting, and that was based on his personal experience.
And now when you say 57 different, you're talking about physically different, or are we talking about, I mean, because, you know, here on this planet, we could have one, you know, there's a number of different races on this planet, but we generally all look alike. These 57 extraterrestrial races that Clifford Stone is talking about, do they all look differently? I mean, are they some reptilians, some look like dogs with brains? I mean, what are they?
Sure. Okay. Yes. Well, if one tried to do a kind of racial genotype of each of these species, you would come up with far fewer, probably 6 to 8 different genotypes, like the reptilian, the gray, the humanoid,
The Nordiques, yeah.
But in terms of different races, as far as their kind of stellar origins are concerned, there are 57. One can differentiate between human races that might come from a particular star system like the Pleiades, as opposed to another star system such as Procyon.
Okay, so we're talking about 57 races from 57 different spots and locations.
That's correct.
Okay. So, and again, let's get back to your report, your study. What was your methodology here? How did you begin to assemble?
Well, basically what I had to do was to look at what are the best sources of evidence for this. I had to begin by really looking at the different reports in terms of, well, is this a whistleblower report, which can be verified in terms of, well, this whistleblower served for X number of years in a military or intelligence organization or some other federal agency? Was this a contactee or an abductee report in terms of, well, was this someone who actually directly interfaced with an ET, spoke to them and entered their ships and was shown what world they came from or was given information from the ETs? Was this a report that came from historical records? Was it something that was telepathically communicated? I had to look at the different categories of evidence and identify, well, which ones of these different sources are the most credible. And so I finally settled for the whistleblower and the contactee reports, because in both cases you had people who had some direct physical interaction with ET races or witness documents, official documents that described the various races and what they were up to.
Are they coming merely from our galaxy, or are they coming from way out in the universe?
Primarily from the galaxy. Some do talk about extragalactic visitors and also interdimensional visitors. Certainly Robert Dean wanted to point out that it was certainly not just ETs from our galaxy, but one had to look at the interdimensional and the extra kind of galactic sources. But the main group of ETs and the kind of councils that are supposed to be involved with regulating these various races on Earth are from our galaxy.
What kind of, I'm going to talk to you about craft, about intelligence, about get your thoughts on the length of time span that they have existed beyond us. But what about the craft first and foremost? How are they getting here?
Well, it seems that the ones that are visiting from the galaxy itself, they use a variety of mechanisms for getting here. The main sources are these large motherships that are described by a number of sources. The size itself is a bit difficult to pinpoint, but you know there have been witness sightings of very large motherships, like the cigar-type motherships that are several kilometres in length.
Yeah, so just immense, right.
Exactly. Something vastly bigger than an aircraft carrier. And then there are the kind of pods or beam ships that come out of these motherships that are the ones that most contactees report when they have their own experiences or are taken up to see the main ET ships, or even to make some kind of interstellar travel. So that you have these smaller ships, and they come in a variety of sizes. The kind of photos that Billy Meyer produced of these circular craft, mm-hmm. that do look like flying saucers, two saucers stuck together, seem to be the predominant shape for these beam ships or these pods that visit.
What about propulsion?
Oh, that's an interesting one. There seems to be some kind of anti-gravity mechanism that is used for traveling around the planet Earth itself. But in terms of the interstellar travel, there are references to this ability to be able to bend time and space.
Ah.
Some kind of warp drive that the Star Trek series kind of fictionalized.
So that's almost instantaneously then. They bend it and they go from point A to point B within seconds, I would guess.
That's right, yes. It's, I think that the main time spent in making these kinds of journeys, for example, the Pleiadians that Billy Meyer worked with described how the time it took for them to get from their world, Terra, in the Pleiadian system. Really, the main time was in the slowing down from exiting this kind of interstellar hyper space drive and navigating through the planets in the orbit of the sun. So they would presumably get into this hyperspace drive out when they are outside of their own solar system, enter the vicinity of our solar system through this hyperspace drive, then they'd come out, and then they would use some kind of anti-gravity propulsion system to be able to navigate the rest of the way to the Earth.
So they may come up, let's say, around Jupiter or something like that?
That's right, yes. Some place where there isn't the kind of concentrated planetary movements.
Michael, in terms of that, do they talk about them being time travelers?
Ah, yes, definitely. The time travel phenomenon is extensively used by these different races, and so it makes it very difficult to actually pinpoint where they come from, because it may involve a different time and space. So, for example, they might describe themselves as coming from the Pleiadian star system, but it may be in a time which might be, say, 300 years in the future. And so that makes it a little difficult in actually understanding how we have a phenomenon of ET visitors, but they might come from different places in the galaxy, but also different time regions in the galaxy. So, for example, if we went to Terra now, in the Pleiadian star constellation,
mm-hmm.
we might find that, well, at the moment there's nothing on Terra, but in say 500 years' time, we have a flourishing civilization. That kind of phenomenon.
Why here? What are they coming here for?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Why here? Why Earth? Given that we are in a relatively primitive state, and they have this advanced technology. I think what would be very indicative of an answer is the great number of races that are interacting in some way with the Earth, 57 or more directly interacting or monitoring the Earth. I think that what that would indicate is that there's some kind of synchronicity or some kind of relationship which might involve some genetic link with these different ET races.
Maybe a universal federation, Michael. You know?
Well, yes, some sort of federation, some kind of association of worlds, probably different groups of associations, similar to how we have different associations on the planet, like the Arab League, the African Union, the European Union.
United Nations.
Exactly.
Like that.
So we have a number of different regional and planetary organizations, so it wouldn't be, I think, wrong to suggest that the ETs have similar types of organizations, and that they are visiting Earth because they have some genetic connection with the different human races.
Maybe they help jumpstart us.
Definitely. I think one looks at the Zechariah Sitchin material and sees here an example of how the Sumerians describe the Anunnaki as having played a role in the beginning of the human race and in genetically upgrading a more primitive species such as Neanderthal into Homo sapiens. So this has happened not just with the Anunnaki, but I believe the evidence suggests that, well, this has happened a great number of times.
Well, Michael, when we come back, I want to ask you if they're all friendly. And, of course, one of the debunkers' criticisms always is, what about the evidence? So we'll talk a little bit about that when we come back as well. Our guest tonight, Dr. Michael Sala. You're listening to Coast AM.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505. City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And our guest tonight, Dr. Michael Sala. His book is Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. And his website is exopolitics.org, linked up with his name on coasttocoastam.com. Let me tell you again about the After Dark newsletter. To those of you who are still on the fence thinking whether you should subscribe or not, you get 14 issues for the price of 12 by calling 1-888-727-5505, or you can also go online anytime you want at coasttocoastam.com. Michael, these various races, and we're going to get into the 57, and then you've concentrated on a certain number of them, but are they all friendly, or do we have some problems here?
Well, I certainly think that that's really the key question here, George. What is a friendly ET, and what is an unfriendly ET? It's a really difficult question because I think that on the surface one can say, well, we can say certain ETs are unfriendly because they do things such as abductions and co-opt particular leaders and officials in various agencies or government organizations. But then one can look at, well, these ETs might simply respond, well, what we've done is we've just entered into agreements with your government authorities, and that as a consequence of these agreements, we've been able to conduct certain experiments with our civilians. And so they might say, well, as a result of that, we've been able to kind of like genetically upgrade certain numbers of individuals, improve their psychic and telepathic abilities, make them more aware of the need to deal with environmental problems and so forth. So a race might simply say that, yes, well, it certainly appears to be unfriendly because we do these invasive procedures after we've abducted civilians without their permission. But then when you look at the result, what you have is individuals who have a higher consciousness, more telepathically gifted and psychically equipped, and so they might say, well, this indicates that we are acting in the best interests of the species. But I think when one considers those kinds of justifications and looks at the great number of ETs interacting and their behaviours, I think we can say that, well, some are friendly because of the whole scope of their activities, and some are unfriendly, or certainly we can be suspicious of them given the whole scope of their activities.
How long have they been coming to this point? It's since the beginning of time?
Well, yes, I think certainly from the very beginning of the human presence on the planet. I don't think that there's any real doubt when one looks at the overall evidence that humans were bioengineered, so that in terms of the human presence on the planet, the ET presence has been from the very beginning of the human presence. So we're talking hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions of years.
And, Michael, let me ask you this. One of the things debunkers will always say, where's the evidence? You know, you might have some indentations, but, you know, that could have been made. You know, we don't have, in terms of seeing, now maybe governments do, where's the craft? Where's the pieces? Where do we have here? You know, years ago somebody gave art some things that were called art's parts that were analyzed and indeed showed some strange anomalies in the metal. But where is the evidence?
Well, the best evidence, I think, are the whistleblower testimonies about what is actually going on in the various compartmentalized projects that are located throughout the U.S. And so when one looks at the inability of various congressional oversight committees to find out what's happening in these projects after their different constituents have asked them to look into it, then one sees that, well, there's evidence of compartmentalized projects that there is top secrecy over, even above top secret security classifications given to these, where there are provisions in place to punish whistleblowers from the military intelligence community who discuss the ET presence. So you look at such things as the laws in place. For example, there's the Joint Army-Navy Air Publication 146 that was passed in 1953-54 that actually makes it an offence for military officials to disclose information about the ET presence. 10 years imprisonment and $10,000 fine back in 53-54. So we're talking about a system that has been put in place that precludes the evidence, the physical evidence, from coming into the public arena, because any official that discloses this is immediately going to be arrested for breaking 146. So when one looks at that kind of skeptical or debunker claim, well, where's the evidence? One has to say, well, look, here's a system set up to preclude that. So, and here's the evidence of that system, and you can refer to these laws. You can refer to JNEP 146. It's actually now been revealed after having been for many decades a state secret, and you can look at the whistleblowers and in terms of their testimonies of what they saw and did.
But in terms of strong evidence, what would you say would be the strongest evidence that we're being visited by not only 57, by at least one?
Sure. Well, the strongest evidence are the crashed discs. I mean, when you have a UFO that has actually crashed as a consequence of whatever environmental anomaly, or whether it's some kind of specific targeted, it's been targeted by some kind of technology, and you have these crashes, and you have military personnel cordoning off an area and actually making sure that all witnesses are intimidated into silence, and then they sanitize the area, remove all the evidence, and then you have whistleblowers coming forward later discussing what actually did happen, then I think you have very strong evidence that, yes, there is a process underway for sanitizing, hiding the ET phenomenon, and the 1947 Roswell crash is probably the best example, and there have been many others since that time.
Have you taken a stand on this Dan Burrish case? You've heard about it, I'm sure.
Well, definitely, yes. We did talk about it some time ago, and I think that he is who he claims to be, a participant in one of these clandestine projects. But, I mean, there's a lot surrounding how he's able to get his information out into the public and what the agendas are behind that.
I've asked him through Linda Moulton Howe to take a lie detector test, and I don't think it is going to happen.
Well, yes, that's a shame that he's not going to come out into the open. But I
mean, would that offend you if you made a claim like he has, and you know, a legitimate media source says, okay, just would you take this lie detector test? We're going to pay for it. As a matter of fact, UFO Magazine and Coast to Coast will do it jointly. I mean, would you be offended? I would do it. You know, I would say, look, I'm gonna back up my claims, and if you don't believe me, here's one way that I'm gonna try to prove it to you.
Well, yeah, I think he would understand that that's a legitimate request, because there is a skeptical public out there, and a lie detector is one way to satisfy that kind of skepticism. So I'm sure he could understand why there would be a need. Or why that would be a legitimate request. As to why he didn't do it, well, I guess he has his own reasons for that. I haven't read fully what exactly are those reasons, but I think it's legitimate to make that kind of request.
Now, of these 57 different races, you concentrate on about 17 of them, Michael. Why is that?
Well, I looked at what is the difference between those races that are interacting directly with the human population, as opposed to those that are primarily here in an observer capacity, just to monitor the Earth and what's happening here. We're kind of like a big show in a way.
All right, and give me your definition of interacting with the human population.
Interacting either through an agreement with the government,
okay,
or through contacts with civilians. In terms of actually having civilians taken on board these ships,
so abductions.
Abductions would definitely be a form of interaction.
Okay.
So yes, anything that actually is more than just observing, something like just watching a big kind of planetary show from some distance and not doing anything more than just watching.
Who are those 17 ET races?
Well, that is what I've done most work on in terms of this report that just came out, and there are some tables that I notice are on your website just outlining these different races. I divide them on the basis of those races that have made some direct connection with the government through a series of agreements, and those races that chose to stay outside of these agreements. So that was the main way of differentiating between the different races.
And let me read just a few of them for us, Michael, and then we'll come back to them. Short grays, okay?
Yes.
Tall grays, reptilians, draconian reptilians, Syrians, and I don't mean those from the country of Syria by any means, the Anunnaki. And let me continue. The Talosians, which are earthbound, you say, right?
Yes, that's correct. Subterranean.
Lyrians, Pleiadians, Procons, and get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, those of you who have a computer. Tassetians, Andromedians. Syrians is from Sirius A, the two-star system, of course. Alpha Centurions, Amites. You've done great homework here, Michael, and at least breaking down the races, their main activities, and I'll tell you what's also fascinating. You say that most of them are assisting in global solutions right now. How are they interacting in that regard?
Well, yes, that's right. I think that the majority of these races are helping with the solution of a whole series of global problems, and they're helping through a number of ways. They're helping through some direct interaction with humans in terms of giving or releasing information. For example, the Umites, they were established in Spain and France during the right from the 1950s up until later the 1980s was when they supposedly left. And during this time, they released a lot of information, scientific information, technical information that was dispersed through various European UFO organizations to the general public and to scientific institutions. And this information had a lot of relevance in terms of new paradigms in scientific and technical thinking. So that was something that the Umites did. Other races, for example, the Andromedans, they are a race that the contactee Alex Collier has had most interaction with, and they pass on information concerning the kind of system that we have in place here and what exactly might be done to resolve the problem. So they release that information through a contactee like Alex Collier.
Do you believe Alex's stories?
Yes, I've actually interviewed Alex and had the chance to speak to some people who know of Alex, and to my mind, he is credible. I think he has been able to give a lot of information that is relevant. He was silenced. That was the thing that I found to be most fascinating, and also, in my mind, confirmed what I have detected in terms of contactees, that they are silenced. The big difference between the contactee community and the abductee community is that abductees talk about negative ETs and the horrible things or the disturbing things that mm-hmm. happen. Mm-hmm. By and large, abductees are kind of not really treated or given special attention by the security agencies. But the contactees who talk about these positive ETs, these humans who basically look like us and the kind of wonderful technologies that they have, they are very severely repressed. Their information is really very dangerous to the system that has been set up, because their information concerns positive ETs, ones who are here helping us. And Alex Collier did actually go through that and did divulge to me the process whereby he was basically silenced.
Are there some ETs on this planet who are here for not good purposes?
Definitely. There are some races that are here basically to harvest humanity for the various resources that we possess, and that they have been doing this for an extensive period of time. And I think a system has been set up whereby this can be done in an efficient way, where humans are not by and large aware of this harvesting process, whereby our resources are basically taken away in a fashion that isn't noticeable to the general public, but is still very efficient and basically is done for the benefit of these ET races that have been doing this harvesting for centuries and decades, at least.
How can the other races stop them?
Well, the primary way of stopping this kind of negative interaction is by individual and collective groups of humans basically having an assent or having a clear intent as to who it is that they want to work with. If there's ignorance about the ET presence, I think that's a general sign that people basically don't want to know about ETs. And so that basically is a form of permission for negative ETs or those that don't respect human rights or the human free will to basically intervene and do whatever they like, because the argument is, well, the humans don't care. You know, they don't believe that ETs are real, so if they don't believe we're real, well, then we can go in and do what we like, because they have shown that they are not really concerned about the ET presence, and so they're displaying an ignorance, and we can exploit that ignorance. Mm-hmm. And there are other ET groups that say, well, if humans at an individual or collective level have a clear intent to interact with ETs that are beneficial, well, then that will happen. And that is exactly the process, I think, that we need to look at here. As individuals have that clear intent, then they will draw into their, well, whether you call it an energy field or whether you call it a kind of national environment or arena, those ETs that can play a positive role.
Are some of these ETs grabbing human beings and just taking them off the face of the planet?
Definitely. I think the abductee witness reports...
And not bringing them back.
Okay. I believe that is occurring in a way that isn't noticeable. I think most abductees, by and large, have the kind of experience which you see in the abduction reports of being taken on board these ships, typically grey ships where the short, kind of 3 to 4 foot tall humanoid mm-hmm. greys do these invasive medical procedures and genetic experiments, and also show them the products of those genetic experiments, like these hybrid children. Most of those abductees are returned without any great harm other than the kind of trauma associated with an abduction and invasive medical procedures. But there are reports of humans being taken off the planet for much longer periods and basically harvested.
All right. We'll be right back with you, Michael. I want to check in with you and see if you've seen the USA show, the 4400, where they were taken and then brought back, and see if that is indeed happening as well then. I'll be right back. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter online at www.coasttocoastam.com. Just click through the orange type to the secure server.